Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.
The doors keep swinging at the Department of Health and Human Services. CDC Director Susan Meñares was fired. FDA's Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research Director Vinay Prasad stepped down. FDA Commissioner Marty Makary resigned, all under Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s watch. RFK Jr. also fired both vice chairs of the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, dismissed all 17 members of the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee, and gutted his own agency with 10,000 HHS employees gone through mass layoffs and another 10,000 employees leaving via early retirement or deferred resignation. With multiple top health agencies now run by acting officials, who is actually steering America's public health? As the hantavirus cruise ship outbreak winds down, a new Ebola outbreak is rapidly spreading. What happens to patients when no one's in charge? In this episode of Care Talk, Kayla Hancock from Protect Our Care does a deep dive into the leadership vacuum at HHS and why it matters for your health. Welcome to Care Talk Live, a weekly American healthcare policy show and podcast where we explain how healthcare works or doesn't work and get you answers. I'm Laura Packard, cancer survivor and healthcare advocate, here to help you. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts to get future Care Talk shows. This is personal for me as a cancer survivor. For example, the Preventative Services Task Force determines what preventative screenings insurance has to cover. Leadership chaos at the top leads to real patient consequences. So welcome to Kayla Hancock, the director of the Public Health Project at Protect Our Care.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So let's start with all of this chaos, employees leaving, employees quit, employees fired. What's going on and why is this happening?
Yes. So as you mentioned in the beginning, we are facing a very serious leadership void at HHS. We are currently without a permanent FDA head, without a Surgeon General, CDC director, or a head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is the role that was long held by Dr. Anthony Fauci, and the role he had during the coronavirus pandemic. And it is unclear at this point whether the White House has even bothered to submit the necessary paperwork to the Senate for its CDC and Surgeon General nominees, which they've announced, but there's been no action beyond that. So it seems that there's a bit of a lack of urgency on the part of the administration in terms of actually filling these roles, which is shocking, as the CDC right now is being overseen by the same person who's overseeing the NIH, and who has no medical training and has been, you know, running two major agencies under the Health and Human Services Agency. And so part of what's really concerning, among a few things, is, you know, in the middle of a worsening Ebola outbreak and on the heels of a hantavirus outbreak, and as we're still continuing to work through measles outbreaks throughout the states, we've had all of these positions essentially empty or with acting directors. And most recently, the acting head of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases stepping down right in the middle of this Ebola outbreak. And so it's definitely concerning in terms of our preparedness for public health crises as they may arise. And as we're seeing, there's been quite a few instances of those happening.
So this is about priorities, right? In the East Wing of the White House, demolished. setting up an arena for an ultimate fighting championship match on the White House lawn, and yet not nominating people for these key positions that directly affect our health. What should the White House be doing instead?
Yeah, well, and I think another point to that is just last month, as Trump forced out his FDA commissioner, because he was essentially taking too long to approve flavored vapes that to appeal to kids, because Trump had this idea that these vapes would be kind of marketed to his core base of you know, MAGA teens. The FDA commissioner was pushed out just days after Trump took a $5 million check from big tobacco interests that were upset over the FDA's timing. And so I think this speaks volumes on where the priorities are for these folks. But I think right now the piece that we're really missing is there is a void of competent leadership at the health department. And this void has become a constant public health crisis as more and more threats to our public health continue to come up abroad and at home.
And speaking of those threats to public health, let's talk about the Ebola outbreak, which is expanding, but has not. There are no cases in the United States that we're aware of. But how is a non-functioning public health system in America making everything worse?
Yeah, and I think so. This Ebola outbreak, which is primarily in Central and East Africa right now, in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda, you know, there's been reports of over 1,000 suspected cases, hundreds of suspected deaths, and the situation has exposed several Americans abroad and is very much escalating last months from the reporting that I've seen. And so what is really frustrating from a public health standpoint is this could have been and probably should have been detected and dealt with sooner. We have seen over the course of the past year of the Trump administration and RFK Jr.'s tenure that the sort of bad judgment and worsening priorities have had deadly consequences. And, you know, things like cuts to USAID, which had historically, you know, had programs on the ground and the infrastructure to help identify these outbreaks of Ebola before they could spread to thousands of people. Those cuts have left the workers who've been doing that really incredible work sort of underfunded and unable to operate. And so this has essentially let Ebola and other potential illnesses spread without really any oversight. And I think the bottom line here is that these choices from the Trump administration have really left us the polar opposite of prepared. By gutting Ebola pandemic preparedness infrastructure, both at home and abroad. I think there was a 99% decrease in funding for Ebola since the last outbreak. And these continued, you know, shuttering of USAID and cutting ourselves off from the World Health Organization have really decimated our ability to do this work.
And I think it's important to consider, just like with the hantavirus cruise ship outbreak, that we live in a connected world, and viruses, just like as we saw with COVID, don't stay where they originate. So that's why it's so important to fund the public health infrastructure that catches things early when they could be more contained, as opposed to COVID spread around the globe and millions died because of that. Ebola is not at that point now. And because it's so deadly, it's actually harder to spread because people are not in a position to travel as much if they are sick with Ebola. But we're vulnerable because of these cuts to public health, right?
Yeah, and I think that is what first hantavirus and now the Ebola outbreak has really shown, is that, you know, while these will likely not turn into full-blown pandemics or, you know, maybe not even come to the United States, it is revealing the fractures in our public health infrastructure and the consistent attacks from this administration on our healthcare and public health infrastructure is really starting to come to light. And we're starting to see that, you know, if potentially there is some sort of more easily spread virus or pandemic or major public health concern, we are really not in the best position that we could be to do that. And I think Americans are seeing that as well. There was polling, I believe, fairly recently, I think it was Data for Progress had done, that showed that a majority of Americans don't think we are prepared for any public health crises. And I think that they're onto something.
Would you say that RFK's, specifically RFK Jr.'s anti-vax views threaten developments, you know, it threatens the funding and the science that could be creating vaccines for Ebola, for our hantavirus, for these emerging diseases, that the cuts threaten treatments, cures, prevention?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I think just at the most basic level, cutting ourselves off from the World Health Organization and not participating in this global response to these outbreaks and viruses in and of itself has been detrimental. You know, ousting 80% of the top officials at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which study these things. There are not nearly as many people doing this work as there have been in the past. And it's leaving us less prepared. I mean, I think the other part that is a little bit less, you know, tangible, that we're seeing all these cuts, we're seeing less scientists doing this research, but there's also this rhetoric coming from the administration on, you know, promoting skepticism around vaccines and science and reducing recommendations for childhood vaccines and kind of sowing confusion between doctors and parents. And so the more and more that we're not only cutting funding, cutting access to research and undermining our biomedical research capabilities, but also spreading this rhetoric and kind of pushing to the American people that, you know, science is not science, or these things are not going to prevent illness, is only going to harm us more.
So what should our public health infrastructure, you know, from our Trump and RFK Jr. on down, what should they be doing right now in this moment?
Yeah, I think the first thing, and why I'm excited to talk about this today, is getting our government staffed. I mean, we don't have any leadership, really. There's no adults in the room right now at HHS, at CDC, NIH. All of this infrastructure that we've built has no leadership. And so I think there's a lack of preparedness from that standpoint, but also funding the science and funding the researchers and reinstating some of the funding for career scientists and folks to do this job needs to be a priority for this organization, or for this this country, because right now we just are falling far behind what we had previously been leaders in doing.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the tough things with finding good career scientists and medical professionals, non-political hacks to run these agencies, is that to get RFK Jr.'s blessing and to get approved by a Senate that is very skeptical of these anti-science nominees is near impossible. Do you think that we could see acting directors? Do you think that this chaos and lack of leadership at the top is going to continue because there is no way to get respected scientists to run these agencies, to get approval by RFK Jr. and by the Senate and by Trump, all of these competing forces?
I mean, absolutely. And I think this administration, and particularly RFK Jr., make it incredibly difficult for anyone to want to do these jobs. I think the people, the rare qualified competent candidate that we've, you know, have been maybe even floated for things are not willing to endorse RFK's anti-vaccine, anti-science sort of rhetoric and not willing to back him up on those things. And so it leaves the opportunities for some of these nominees as, you know, like wellness influencers, as we've seen in the past, or people who are just willing to sort of parrot RFK's debunked ideas. And so we're not getting qualified candidates. And I highly doubt we'll see any while RFK is overseeing this department.
Well, then it sounds like our public health crisis will continue. Where can people find out and get the latest about Public Health Project?
Yes. Well, unfortunately, on the public health crisis front, but for more information, we are at protectourcare.org, and we're constantly trying to get all of this information out to the public, to the media, to just continue to show folks where this administration's priorities lie, and particularly how public health has been kind of number one on the chopping block as they continue to prioritize tax cuts for billionaires and cutting healthcare for Americans. So,
well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And a reminder that we have free or low-cost healthcare resources available on our website at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk, so check it out. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. And now our experts will answer your health insurance questions. So welcome to Louise Norris, health insurance and healthcare reform analyst at healthinsurance.org, and Diane Archer, the founder and president of Just Care USA. So let's start with Louise, because there's been some changes to the Affordable Care Act insurance marketplace that will take effect for next year. So tell us, what's going on?
Yeah, so just in a couple of weeks ago, CMS finalized their annual rulemaking process for 2027. There's a lot of stuff in the rule, but some of it is sort of more behind the scenes. As far as things that consumers will actually see, I think some of the most important ones to highlight are that they're going to step up the documentation required as far as proving your income when you go to enroll in the marketplace, specifically for folks who like the files that the government has on file already, like through the IRS, show that your income is under the poverty level, but you're attesting to an income above the poverty level, because you have to have an income above the poverty level to get subsidies. They are cracking down on that and saying if that's the circumstance, then they're going to require you to provide more proof as opposed to just attesting to your income. And also special enrollment periods, having more documentation required. So you can't just attest to having a qualifying life event. They already do require documentation if your special enrollment period is for loss of other coverage. But they're going to step it up for other qualifying life events as well. And it's important to note that both of these provisions had been in previous rulemaking and had been overturned or blocked by a court. So it is still possible that there could be yet another court case. This could get blocked again. But assuming it goes as scheduled right now, these will take effect for 2027. So when people are signing up for marketplace plans this fall, even if in the past you haven't been required to provide income documentation, you should expect that you expect to need to provide that. If they don't ask for it, that's great, but assume they're going to ask for it, especially if your income's on the lower end of the income spectrum. And then another important thing for 2027 is some bronze marketplace plans will be allowed to have maximum out-of-pockets as high as $15,600. The general limit that applies to all plans, including employer-sponsored plans, marketplace plans, for 2027, the absolute highest they can have their maximum out-of-pocket is $12,000 for one person. But there will be some bronze plans that can go to 130% of that, so $15,600. The reason this is important is because if you are a consumer and you're just sort of brushing through real quick and you're just looking at premiums and deductibles, for example, you might see a plan with a low deductible and think, that it's great, and if you're missing the fact that it has a $15,600 maximum out-of-pocket limit, that's not the sort of thing you want to find out partway through the year when you're hospitalized and you realize you owe a lot more money than you thought you did. So it's just, you know, consumers need to really pay attention to what plans are available in their area this fall. Open enrollment is only 5 months away now, so this is the sort of thing you're going to want to pay attention to. There were some other provisions, such as plans not having, some plans being allowed to be in the marketplace with no provider networks. That got pushed off to 2028. Also, catastrophic plans in the marketplace having maximum out-of-pockets equal to 130% of the regular maximum out-of-pocket, that also got pushed out to 2028. So we'll talk about those, but we'll talk about them next year. The other thing that I did want to mention to folks is we are already seeing quite a bit of activity as far as insurers announcing exits from the marketplace for this fall for 2027. So far, we've seen 5 insurance companies across 14 states and about 600,000 enrollees affected. And we are very early in the process still. Most states, we don't have rates and plan filings yet. So pay close attention to any information you get from your insurer or the marketplace as we head towards open enrollment. If your carrier's exiting the marketplace, in most cases, the marketplace will just auto renew you into a new plan, but that's not in your best interest. It's always in your best interest to actively pick your own replacement plan. So just, I know we're still several months out from this, but it's definitely something people should be heads up for. And we've been talking for months on this show over since last year about all the federal changes that were harming the marketplace as far as reducing enrollment. When you have reduced enrollment, it tends to be the healthier people who leave. So you end up with a smaller, sicker risk pool. This is a big factor in why these insurance companies are leaving, because the insurance companies won't stay in a market that's not profitable for them. So the smaller the overall risk pool gets and the sicker it gets, the less likely insurance companies are to want to participate in the market.
Thanks, Louise. And one more question for you. You mentioned some of these bronze plans would have a $15,000 out-of-pocket maximum, but they might have a lower deductible. Can you just explain the difference between an out-of-pocket maximum and a deductible? Because some people might think they're the same thing.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great point. So the deductible is, for most services, you have to pay that deductible before the health insurance policy starts to pay. Depending on how the plan is designed, you might have copays for an office visit or copays for prescription drugs, but other services, in general, you have to meet that deductible before the plan starts to pay. And then after you meet that deductible, you switch to coinsurance. That's where, you know, people might be familiar with like an 80-20 plan where you pay 20%, the insurance company pays 80%. Some plans are 70-30, even 50-50. But that maximum out of pocket, once you've paid whatever the maximum out of pocket limit is, and you're staying in network and you're getting all your prior authorization and following the plan's rules, you then don't have to pay anything for the rest of the year. So it's not like you pay 80-20 forever. It's only until you hit that maximum out of pocket. And so if you have a plan, in some plans, the deductible is equal to the maximum out of pocket. You might have a plan with a $10,000 deductible, and that is also the maximum out of pocket. So once you meet your deductible, the plan just starts paying for everything you need for the rest of the year. But it's quite common to see plans where the deductible is some amount less than the maximum out of pocket. So you hit your deductible, then you switch over to, instead of you paying the full cost, it's being split between you and the insurance company. And the insurance company doesn't start paying 100% until you hit that maximum out of pocket. So you do need to pay attention to both numbers. And like I say, sometimes they're very close to each other and the deductible is always included in the maximum out of pocket. But sometimes there can be a lot of deviation. And that was actually one of the reasons they made this rule, is to provide more flexibility so that carriers can do lower deductibles and provide more pre-deductible coverage. But you don't want to not understand what's your maximum out of pocket. That's your worst case scenario. Something really bad happens, you're in the hospital, you're needing surgery, whatever it is. as long as you stay in network and get care that's covered by your plan, you don't pay more than that out-of-pocket maximum, but you want to know what that number is going into the year.
Thank you, Louise. And now for Diane, Penman on Reddit says that my new Medicare drug insurance plan denied a prescription I've had for years for a reason they don't understand. My prescription was for 75 milligrams a day, and so my doctor had it for 325 milligram pills, which makes sense because the drug is available in 25, 50, and higher sizes. The insurer denied the prescription, saying it exceeded their plan maximum of 60 pills for a 30-day period. So you had to get a different size pill and had to break some in half, and it's just irritating. So Diane, what's going on with this?
It's a great question, and it really is just so irritating and frustrating to have to deal with. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense because your insurer won't cover more than 60, 25 milligram pills a month, but it will cover 45, 50 milligram pills, which you can cut in half in order to get the dose you need. So it's like six of one, half a dozen of the other, but still you have to be cutting your pills in half. It's really likely that this rule limiting the number of pills you can get each month is just a way for the insurer to limit its spending and maximize profits. In most cases, if people can only get a certain number of pills, then they'll at one fell swoop, then they'll have to pay a new co-payment when they get the next set of pills. So every new prescription filled is another copay, another chance to do prior authorization for the insurance company, and another way for the insurance company to withhold spending and maximize its revenues. But in your case, as you say, that argument makes little sense since you can split your pills. So one thing you might want to do is to ask your doctor to request a quantity limit exception for your drug with the insurer, because it doesn't really make sense that you can get double the quantity that you need and cut the pills in half. And that might work. But if it doesn't work, you might go in the other direction and you might ask your doctor to prescribe you 60 tablets of the 50 milligram pill as opposed to 45, and that would mean you would be renewing your prescription less frequently, and so arguably in many cases paying less in copays for your drug. But the final thing you might try to do, if neither of those things work, is to see if maybe you can get the 25 milligram drug dosage that you really want through a mail order pharmacy. Sometimes the mail order pharmacies are willing to give you a larger quantity of the drug that you're looking for. All of it is a big fat headache. All of it are just ways that the insurers try to keep the money that you're giving them in premiums for themselves and maximize their profits.
Thank you, Diane. And then a question for Louise from Silly Swifty on Reddit, who is currently receiving cancer care at the number one cancer hospital for their type of cancer. Their doctor recommended a specific treatment, but the insurance company said no, saying that it's not FDA approved for this specific indication and is off-label or investigational. I've been denied by a self-funded plan, and ironically, they're an employee of the same university system as MD Anderson, where they're getting their care on a plan for that university, seeking treatment at one of their hospitals. This person tried filing a complaint with their state's commissioner, but couldn't because it's a self-funded plan. They applied for the Johnson & Johnson Patient Assistance Program for the drug, but was denied because they didn't meet the income guidelines. So what, if anything, can they do about this insurance decision?
So this sounds like such a frustrating situation, especially given the relationship between their employer and the hospital system. It's correct that the insurance commissioner in your state can't do anything about self-insured plans. Those are not state regulated, and that patient assistance programs through pharmaceutical companies generally do have income requirements that you have to meet in order to qualify. And I don't know how far this person got with appealing the denial, whether they have appealed it yet or not, but it is important to note that under the ACA, as long as the plan isn't grandfathered, if it's a, it doesn't matter if it's self-insured or not, the ACA appeals process is available, which means you get an internal appeal. You also get an external appeal. So the internal appeal is where you just appeal directly to the health plan. You get documentation from your doctor. You know, you explain basically any extenuating information that might help them to see why you really need this care. If that fails and they still don't agree to cover it, then you are guaranteed access to an external review, which means an independent third party is looking at this case to see whether the appeal should, whether the denial should stand or whether they should have to cover this, this care. So if you haven't appealed yet with your health plan, the first step is to start the internal appeal, and you can just reach out to the health plan and ask them, where do I submit this? What information do you need to see? And then you definitely want to get your doctor on board with helping, because they can really help with the details of why this is needed. And then if the internal appeal fails, it should include information for you on how to proceed to the next step of seeking an external review. So best of luck, but just know that even though your plan is self-insured, you do have access to those, the, those appeals processes.
Thank you, Louise. And thank you to everyone who joined us today. Be sure to check out more free or low-cost healthcare resources on our website at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. Join us next week for more. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Laura Packard, and this is Care Talk.
It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.